wake up in the morning, I go whoopee. When I go to bed at night, I go whoopee. I say, here comes the colonel. Whoopee, whoopee, whoopee.
It's not that funny. It's just not that funny. It's not that funny, I'm telling you. Well, welcome back. The second half hour of The Promise of Tomorrow here on the Science News Radio Network. Exploring the business of emerging science, nanotechnology, open innovation. I'm your host. I'm Colonel Mason. We've got an exciting second half hour for you because we're going to hear from Daniel M. Gerstein, the Deputy Undersecretary for Science and Technology, Department of Homeland Security. He's going to be a speaker at the IEEE Homeland Security Technology Conference going on in the middle of November in Boston. You can find out more about that conference by going to our website and promiseoftomorrow.biz, and on the right-hand side of your screen, you'll see a link, and you can link to it. And of course, at the end of the program, listener comments and the voice of reason. Also, in light of the EPA's announcement recently that they were going to limit the emissions on the coal plants, we brought back an old interview of the late Dr. Stephen Snyder. But right now, though, let's step over to our Fountain of Useless Information.
Welcome to the Fountain of Useless Information. How can I help you?
Simply throwing in the coins arouses the spirit of the fountain, wakens him up to answer our query for today. All right, oh, spirit of the fountain, put your thinking cap on this time. What bird was last seen in the wild on an island in 1681? A bird that was last seen wild on an island in 1681. What bird was it, O Spirit of the Fountain?
I have given you my answer, and now you may tell the others.
The Spirit of the Fountain knows all about extinct birds. Well, yes, of course, you've got this one, don't you? We all know of the famous extinct bird is, of course, the dodo bird. All right, now on to our guest in the second half hour of the program. All right, we have back with us Dr. Daniel M. Gerstein, and he's the author of National Security and Arms Control in the Age of Biotechnology, the Biological and Toxin Weapons Convention. And he's written that book, and we've got him on the program. And welcome to the program. Welcome back, Dan.
Well, thanks. Thanks for having me.
Now, this book expertly details the history and implementation of the Biological and Toxin Weapons Convention, that controversial arms control agreement drafted in the 70s to supplement the Geneva Protocol for warfare from decades earlier, and it banned the use of biological weapons in modern warfare, but failed to ban their development, transport, or trafficking. And you've had plenty to say about that in the book. Can you kind of give us an overview?
So, you know, the motivation for writing the book was that I had been working in the Pentagon and actually doing these sorts of issues. And what I discovered in the course of this was that we had a policy which called for absolutely no discussion on verification. And so verification happens to be one of the big sticking points in this. I became more and more interested with a trip that I took over to discuss this with some of our allies. And during this trip, I happened to mention verification in an open forum, and I had a colleague from one of the interagency departments within our government come up and give me quite a tongue lashing about the use of the term verification and how we don't use that term. And so I became more interested in understanding why we don't use that and what it means. I also had the opportunity to go to the 2011 review conference in Geneva, and it's an incredible opportunity to see how an international forum works or doesn't work. And this three-week session, I only got to attend about 2 days of it, but this three-week session occurs every 5 years. And during the course of this, I was able to give a presentation on national implementation of the Biological Weapons Convention. And I became absolutely convinced that it's an important topic and one that is very much misunderstood, not well understood, even by those responsible for having daily activity that would be covered under such a convention. So I felt like it was a story and a discussion that needed to occur.
And, you know, is verification still not a word that's being used? I mean, we had Ronald Reagan when he says trust everybody, but verify, and it seems that verification is just such a logical thing. Is that changed?
No, it actually hasn't changed. I mean, we still do not have a policy that allows for a coherent discussion of verification, and I don't say that. From the standpoint of these are not people who are not well-meaning. It's not that they haven't thought through the problems. The issue is that we have a fundamental feeling about verification. We know that it's very difficult to verify biological warfare activities, whereas, you know, we have become very comfortable with verification, as you point out, in the Reagan years, for example, when trust but verify. We have become very willing to discuss and have verification regimes associated with nuclear weapons, for example, even conventional arms control, and even chemical arms control. But in the biological field, it's just been something that we have been reticent to have a serious discussion on.
Well, as an author of this particular book, you must be certainly appalled at the situation in Syria when, as of today, we haven't been able to verify who is using these biological weapons or where they're coming from. Is there information that is not getting out yet to the American people that nations know and understand about it? And how do you feel about what's going on in Syria?
Well, let me say first, correct the record, that in Syria we have no reason to believe that biological weapons are being used. The assertions are that these are chemical weapons from within the stockpile of the Syrian government. And I have no firsthand knowledge. That's not my issue set, so I really don't work on that piece. But the use of chemical and biological weapons is something that we consider abhorrent forms of warfare. And so they're not to be used, and that's the reason why we have the BWC and the CWC. And so, you know, that's an area where, you know, we globally feel that there are modern forms of warfare, and these should not be included in them.
All right, and maybe we can touch on your other book, that Assignment Pentagon, that you wrote, and how to get along in Washington. I haven't read the book, but I've seen some flyers on it, and maybe you can kind of give us a view of what you did with that one.
Well, so I'm a co-author on that book with a retired Major General, Perry Smith, formerly, he is an Air Force retired two-star, and of course I brought my Army roots to the book. And what we do is we try to have a discussion about how to be successful working in a large bureaucracy in the Pentagon. The Pentagon is an extraordinary place, 25,000 people a day. Come in and work in that facility. It's the largest office building in the world. It is the head, if you will, of a global defense consortium, which has people stationed in over 150 countries around the world. It has several million people in uniform and civilians that are part of this global enterprise, and so it's a fascinating place to work. And what we were trying to do in here was to give the opportunity to understand what it's going to be like for those who work there, to maybe give them some helpful hints, for those who are coming to the Pentagon to try to tell them what they need to do to be prepared to work in the headquarters of the largest multinational organization around the globe.
Do you have one succinct piece of advice to watch out for and to pay attention to if you're going to deal in the Pentagon?
I would say the biggest thing that you have to consider is you have to let your moral compass guide you. You will be faced with many difficult decisions. Some of them will have lots of downsides and not so many upsides, but you have to do the right thing. The American people, the government of the United States is counting on that sort of ethical, moral compass to be guiding the people who work in that building.
The implications of the BWC, the Biological Toxin Weapons Convention, why is this important?
Well, that's an interesting question. When I first started writing the book, the working title was The BWC, the Most Important Arms Control Treaty of the 21st Century That You've Never Heard Of. Mm-hmm. And centered around that were 10 reasons why the BWC matters. And it starts with the idea that the BWC eliminates an entire class of very, very dangerous weapons. It also provides us a norm against the use of these weapons. It has an extraordinary economic dimension. In fact, it's approximately 20% of the U.S. economy when you add in agriculture, public health, biotechnology, medicine, and healthcare. And then at the end of that long list of 10 is the BWC actually requires implementation of the convention from international organizations to each and every individual. Mm-hmm. We are all part of this machine that contributes to the success of the Biological Weapons Convention. We don't always think in those terms, but individuals who are receiving health care and who are doing, monitoring their health ought to understand what emerging infectious disease can look like and be able to listen to governments and take appropriate actions to both protect themselves and their families, but also in the event that they were infected with some sort of biological agent, that they would do the right thing as they were instructed to be able to do. And so some of this means that there's a self-awareness that has to come as we think about having people who are prepared for a bio event. And in a bio event, I'm not just talking about the use of biological weapons, but I'm talking about everything down to and including things such as pandemics. You know, that's one of the issues that we expect that people will be able to listen and be able to respond appropriately to.
So this is an ongoing thing. It has to constantly be studied and constantly be watched and constantly babysat. Is that what you're saying?
Well, yes. It's a topic that we have to have great vigilance on. We have to understand that when there are emerging infectious disease reports, that we're doing, we're taking appropriate actions, again, to keep ourselves healthy, to avoid situations where we could become casualties, and, you know, to the maximum extent possible. That starts with a good public health system. It starts with proper health of individuals. And so that's why it's so interesting that the BWC could have this sort of impact. But again, when you go back and you think that the BWC actually has application across 20% of the U.S. economy, that's a pretty staggering amount.
Yeah, that's right. It's hard to get your arms around that. I mean, I hadn't considered this before, and you really point out a very important thing.
Well, thanks. Yeah, I think it is important, and so it's an area that I think is probably under-discussed within the national security environment.
Well, Dr. Daniel M. Gerstein, author of The National Security and Arms Control in the Age of Biotechnology, the Biological and Toxin Weapons Convention, thank you very much for giving us an overview of the book. Also, author of Assignment Pentagon, which is a popular book for those who are getting to the Pentagon for the first time and want to know how to navigate the areas of it. You've been a wonderful guest. We really do appreciate it. Thanks so much for being with us.
Well, thanks again for having me.
The EPA's ruling this past week that they're going to start strictly enforcing carbon emissions from coal plants reminded me of a conversation I had with the late Stephen Snyder from Stanford University, climate scientist, back about 4 years ago. And we got on that very subject, and I asked him, I said, you totally agree with Al Gore? And he said, no, he said, I don't really.
He tends not to frame it as much as a risk management problem as I do, sort of as a moral imperative. Now, I don't disagree with that, but that's his framing. My framing is, yes, for me it's a moral imperative, but that's my personal value judgment. I think that society is more likely to be interested in inefficient risk management than in the moral imperative argument, where you just get into all different arguments and people with different opinions. So yes, I certainly endorse the overall thing. Somebody once said, well, does he get it always right? No. I mean, if I tried to correlate the statements of Al Gore with the statements of the IPCC, I think, 80% of the time he's pretty close. Sorry to say this, but if I tried to correlate the statements of Rush Limbaugh, George Will, with the statements of the IPCC, 95% of the time they get it wrong. So I'm certainly more with Gore than with them on this. But in terms of solutions, I tend to frame it more in a business way. You know, every venture capitalist worries about upside and downside risk, and, you know, they have to make certain that their whole portfolio is not threatened with downside risk. And I say exactly the same thing about the Earth. You cannot threaten the Earth with a large, you know, fraction of potentially irreversible downside risk. It makes some safer investments. And in fact, we haven't talked much about technology. That would be, you know, something really important. When you asked me earlier, Colonel, about the, you know, Waxman-Markey and the cap and trade, and my answer was, yes, we need to have a price on carbon in order to get, you know, the signals right. At the same time, we need energy efficiency. There's another point that we need just as much, which is we need incentives to private capital to get all those brilliant startups, because we have incredibly smart technologists in this country and in this planet. And the trouble is that they need to get over the hump in investment. So here's where there could be a role for the federal government. We've had a stimulus package because of a crisis, but we don't need a crisis. We should have a stimulus package that's carefully targeted at very good potential new technologies. How can we invent our way out of this problem with high technology? I think we can, not immediately, not in 10 years, but certainly over 30. And create sustainable green jobs, decouple ourselves from dependence on foreign supplies of energy, and, you know, at the same time protect the environment. You know, look for those win-win-wins. So we'll take investment. No return on investment without investment. And how much? So I was giving talk in Washington. A congressman said to me, he was in the audience, it wasn't a congressional hearing, just, you know, public talk. Okay, I agree with that. He said, we do need public investment. After all, nuclear power was not funded by private sector, it was government. And even the Internet, in spite of the fact that Al Gore supported it, didn't invent it, the Internet, you know, came out of DARPA, which was a defense agency funding. So it's very obvious that all important new technology got started with the government assist, often with military, sometimes direct subsidies. How much did it even cost? I said, well, you know, technology is not cheap, and I don't know, $20, $30 billion a year for the next 10 years. And he said, are you crazy? Don't you read the newspapers? We're in a financial crisis. And I said, excuse me, Congressman, but with all due respect, which anytime anybody says that, look out. Mm-hmm. And I said, didn't we just spend $750 billion of those dollars in 1 year? Bailing out a bunch of under-regulated greedy bankers. You don't want to spend 4% of that every year for the next 10 years to help us invent our way out of a potential planetary risk, and at the same time, by the way, provide some clean, sustainable jobs and decouple ourselves to some degree from foreign supplies of energy that's unreliable? I said, you know, it just seems to me that this is elementary good investment. And he said, well, I agree with you. He said, but a lot of my colleagues don't. I said, they should look in the mirror and see if they need a values transplant.
Yeah, well.
Have an incredibly capable technological capacity. But how do you get VC in there? Always a little reluctant. Loan guarantees? Heck, we got loan guarantees to losers. How about loan guarantees to winners?
Yeah, Yeah. So you believe then that not only something like cap and trade or a carbon tax and, of course, energy efficiency, which you touched upon, but also technology. You think that we can come up with the technological answers to solve the problem of global warming. Is that right?
We can't solve the whole problem. There's no way that this could be implemented, even in the United States and Europe, in less than several decades. You cannot build the machines fast enough to replace them in a decade. I wish my environmental friends would stop the numerology about how many percent below 1990 we're going to cut in 2020. The number that matters between now and 2020 is how many billions are we going to spend inventing new technology to do the job after 2020. The key is we've got to cut like 50 to 80% by the middle of the century. The bad news is that's a lot of cutting. The good news is that's a lot of time. So if we focus so much on the next 5 or 10 years, you know, political lifetime of members of Congress, then what we're going to miss is the opportunity to make the long-term investments in a more orderly manner that really provide us with the technologies that we can use to substitute. So you don't shut down every coal plant tomorrow. As much as an environmental guy think that would be great, we can't do that. It's economically catastrophic. So what you do is you don't replace them. As they go out, now you, in an orderly way, replace them with a whole range of alternatives. And we have what I like to call a learning by doing feeding frenzy. Get out there and let the market of new tech compete. Let's find out which ones are going to be cost effective, socially acceptable, you know, can be made, brought up to scale.
Nobel Prize winning climate scientist Dr. Stephen Snyder, Stanford University. The late Dr. Stephen Snyder, from an interview we recorded August 8th, 2009. And at this time, I want to thank you very much for those of you who have contributed to the this program. We depend on contributions from listeners like you for the existence of this show. We're totally science community supported. So those of you who have contributed, thank you very much. Those of you who wish to can do so at our website, promiseoftomorrow.biz. On the right-hand side of your screen, you'll see a little tab there for donations. Just click the donations, and we appreciate all your help.
And now, we make time for the voice of reason. Listener comments, ideas, and suggestions.
This, I give you these steps. Number one, know who you are. Know who you are. And there's a whole lot of work to do around knowing who you are. Number two is never give up your power, your internal power, to external circumstances. Number three is live on purpose every day. Number four, always, 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 when you fail, fail forward, because we will fail. But fail forward. Keep it simple. Whatever it is, keep it simple. Less is more. You always remember that. Bring the change you want to see in the world. And when you bring it, share the knowledge. That's it. That's it, and that's internal work, and that's individual work. We are self-made. We are created. We are creation, and we need to get back to creating. Those eight steps, or seven or eight that I just gave you, is a personal creed that everybody somehow they need to embody in themselves and then effectuate that in the world around them. That's when we begin to make a difference. No, I said that's when we send the terrorists back home singing. That's when we see them get out of our neighborhoods. That's when we see them move away. That's when we see this stuff stop. Because united we stand, divided we fall. But until we know who we are, we can't unite with others until we unite with ourselves. Francina Tate Hollerath, CEO of Total Protections Global.
So you decide, has this really been the voice of reason? Listener comments are welcome at 214-329-4949. And please tell us your name and where you're from.
You've been listening to The Promise of Tomorrow with Colonel Mason, the definitive program on emerging and nanotechnologies, now archived and streamed on the web at promiseoftomorrow.biz. Join us next week at the same time as we learn more about the promise of tomorrow.
You, I am waiting. seeds for you.